The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. So I think any worthwhile religion should be challenging. And one of the great challenges is the challenge of whether you can live your life without fear. Can you live without fear? And my own first kind of inkling that I was interested in Buddhist practice was when I was looking for something to help me with the fear of death. And I had some feeling, some idea, I don't know where I picked it up, I was probably 19, that Buddhism had something to offer. I didn't know almost nothing about it. I'd read Siddhartha when I was 14. And so that somehow that so I believe Buddhism has helped me with the fear of death. The few times in my adult life where I've been up against situations, health situations or something where, you know, that possibility of death was kind of in the air, I found myself more curious than afraid. So I don't know what will happen for me. But can we live a life without fear? And so what this takes is many things, but it certainly takes an interest to, or a desire, not to keep living with the fear that we have. The anxiety, the worry, the horror, the terror, whatever kind of grip of fear that takes over our lives and affects us, to no longer tolerate it, no longer, I don't want to keep living this way. And sometimes that interest only happens when we see really clearly the shortcomings of having fear. When we feel the danger of having it, you know, what a tremendous, some people, tremendous toll it takes to live a life of fear, worry, anxiety. Some of the things that, some of the shortcomings of this living a life of anxiety is that it limits our life. It keeps us inhibited, so we can't do some of the things we want to do. We can't live sometimes the values that we want to live. Again, you know, my early interest in Buddhism around the fear of death was so closely connected to wanting to live my values and feeling afraid to live my values. And so, just, you know, how it's received by other people, how it can be seen, my sense of security would be threatened if I live my values. So, by living in fear, we live somehow limited in ways that can become quite painful. There's a lot of things that people are afraid of, certainly the fear of death can be one of them. Fear of pain usually rates pretty high. Fear of rejection of other people, social phobias are quite big. Fear of loss of security of all kinds is quite big. Fear of spiders and snakes. You laugh, but in the kind of national lists of top fears, fear of snakes and spiders comes out quite big, quite high. And so, you know, what fears do you live under, and what fears do you have that limit your life, that keep you from living your life fully, or keep you from entering fully into what is most valuable for you, or fear that keeps you from your values? I know some people are afraid of what a spiritual practice will do to them. They're afraid of what a Buddhist practice will do. And sometimes it's the spouse that's afraid of what the Buddhist practice is going to do for their spouse. But there's a certain fear, like, oh no, what's going to happen? I have to give up something. I have to let go of something. I have to face something. And some people intuit at some point that they have to face something in themselves that they'd rather not. They've been protecting themselves for a long time rather than have to deal with that. There's fear to look at that. For me, I remember there was a time after I practiced for a few years where I felt like I really had to face and look at and let go of as a certain conceit I have, a certain kind of way in which I wanted people to see me a certain way. I was very concerned about how people saw me, and I wanted to make a good impression, and I would get involved in social gymnastics of various kinds in order to try to manipulate the situation, try to present the best front to people so that I would kind of try to guarantee they'd see me just the way I'm supposed to be seen, right? Thank you. And I could see that I was doing this, and I was feeling like this doesn't make any sense. It limits me. It's painful to do. It's, you know, why? This constant concern about how people see me and whether people like me or not. And I was afraid of dealing with it. I was afraid of letting go of that. I felt like, you know, it was bad enough to do it. It was worse not to have it. You know, then who am I? You know, then what will I be? And how will I take care of myself? How will I be safe if I don't have this kind of protection and concern that kind of organizes the universe just right so that things can be just safe for me? So to start seeing at some point the limitations of fear is a very important step. And for some people, that's what mindfulness practice does in meditation practice. Is that mindfulness and meditation are both ways that we stop running away from ourselves, stop being distracted from ourselves, stop escaping from ourselves. And it's a call, meditation is really a call to be impeccably honest about to yourself. And so to really stop and see, well, what's really going on here? Who are you and what's happening to you? What motivates you? What are you feeling? And the little cliche is that self-knowledge is seldom good news. Now, that's not always true. It can be good news, for sure. But the cliché points to something that sometimes, especially there are times when that's what meditation's function is, to show parts of ourselves that maybe we'd rather not see, rather not know, rather not deal with. And so we stop and are honest and look and see. And one of those is fear, anxiety. I've been told that... you know, I think many of us know that depression gets a lot of press in the news, and, you know, antidepressive medication, seems like half the population is on them. They say they get, we're very lucky to have these kinds of medications. Some people, it's very important for people to take. But there's a lot of press, a lot of discussion of it. I've been told by people who supposedly know psychologists that a bigger issue in the United States, bigger than depression, is anxiety, though it's not elevated to the same status, maybe because there's not a good medication yet for it. Anxiety is quite big, this issue. And the difference between fear and anxiety is interesting to consider. Fear maybe is just a generic term for a whole range of things, you know, from fretting to full-blown terror. But one differentiation is between fear, which is actual, when there's an actual danger right in front of us, right here, and anxiety, which involves the imagination. So, our imagination is very creative. That's the nature. Imagination and creativity often go together, right? So our imagination of the future, our imagination of what's going to happen, may have very little bearing on reality, may have very little bearing on what's actually going to happen. But we often, the more we live in the world of imagination, and you're fueled by initial kinds of fear, or if it's fueled by memories of challenges in the past, that our creativity can paint wonderful pictures of what's going to happen, and or wonderful feelings of what might happen. And so then we get anxious about these imaginary futures. One of the turning points for me about certain kind of anxiety was the time about 20 years ago when I was anticipating a meeting, and I was very anxious about the meeting. And so I was thinking about it, worried about it, what was going to happen and all that. And that went on for several days, and then the meeting was canceled. And then I looked back and said, what was that about? You know, why... You know, I was worried about something that didn't happen, but even more, I thought, I'm worrying about something that doesn't exist before it exists. And is that really necessary? I felt kind of like this was a wake-up call for me. And that wasn't enough to overcome my anxiety, but it was one of the beginnings of really noticing what a very poor track record I had at predicting the future. That the things that I was anxious about, usually about the future, usually didn't turn out the way that I was kind of thinking they would. And usually things, because they were canceled or the people weren't there, well, all kinds of things happen, right? And it kind of, because I started tracking how poor my predictions were, they started to loosen their grip on me. They started like, oh, okay, well, maybe not, probably not, until finally, we'll see. Until finally, let's not bother. Let's not bother kind of, you know, predicting disaster. And one of the things about fear and predicting disaster is that occasionally it's self-fulfilling. So if we live in a world of fear, sometimes we'll kind of set up the conditions so that dangerous things will happen. I mean, an extreme situation is if you go, if you go in some places in the world and you exhibit fear around the dogs will pick you up, pick out you because of your fear, and they'll more likely to bite you. But if you show confidence and or kindness or relaxation, then they're less likely to bite you. And people are the same way. Sometimes people will pick out the people who are timid or afraid in the crowd and pick on them because they're like maybe easy target. So it becomes self-fulfilling, you know. Same thing with anger. Sometimes angry people, are angry with the situations they're in. And because, you know, they think everyone's out to get them or bad or something. But because they're angry, people react to their anger. And so it becomes self-fulfilling. If they weren't angry to begin with, people wouldn't have responded that way. So this self-fulfilling way in which certain emotions can operate in our life, and that gives us the proof that this is the way it is. So fear is a common part of life. And so mindfulness practice, when fear arises, mindfulness practice meets it, is present for it. And can we be free of fear? The initial task of mindfulness is not to be free of it, but to be free from it. So what that means is that we don't expect to get rid of it and to be fear-free, but we learn to kind of turn towards it and see it clearly for what it is, to note it, to be aware of it, to be mindful of it. And initially, sometimes, that can make you more afraid because a touching fear can kind of evoke it more strongly. And occasionally, if it becomes too strong, turning towards it, then it's counterindicated. That's kind of what a panic attack can sometimes be. And so sometimes you don't want to turn towards it, but the basic idea of mindfulness is, in fact, to turn towards it. And then by learning to be mindful of it, to learn to separate yourself from the fear so that you are not the fear, so that the fear isn't your whole being, but rather the fear is just not my fear, it's just the fear. To have the ability to observe it and have the fear be something that's observed rather than being the observer. If you use that kind of language, you can be the strong observer, and the observer is not the fear, but is observing the fear, as opposed to the observer and the fear being the same. The observer is the frightened one. So to use mindfulness to clearly see it. So some people find that the mental noting is very helpful. We use in mindfulness this little technique of labeling something, like fear, you'd say fear, And you say it in a way, maybe be creative in how you say it in your mind, so that you begin kind of like not taking it so seriously or pulling back or being the observer or separating yourselves or not being caught in it. And sometimes if it's a lot of anxiety, it's helpful to use the mental notes more fully as a whole sentence. I love Joseph Goldstein had a little technique where he would add the word, "And the sky is blue," at the end of like, you would say, "I'm afraid right now. I'm really afraid right now." yeah, I am afraid right now. Maybe you say it loud. Boy, am I really afraid like right now. There's a lot of fear. Until it starts becoming like the saying it becomes bigger than the fear. It's like you're a little bit separated. And then the sky is blue. You know, it's kind of like puts it in a different context. You know, like, oh, it's just fear. And this is one of the great little steps for some people when they do mindfulness practice, to come to a point where they can be present for their fear and they can say to themselves, it's just fear. Fear is a basic human emotion. It's not a mistake that you should have fear. I mean, we're wired to have fear. It's not an embarrassment. It doesn't mean that you have to kind of believe the fear. It doesn't mean you have to be pushed around by it. It's just fear. And this ability to kind of step back and just kind of let it be there is tremendously freeing for some people. Some people find that that step of becoming the observer, stepping away from fear, is helped a lot by feeling the fear in the body. Sometimes grounding your attention in the body where the fear is takes us out of the imagination that is fueling the fear. So to feel the stomach in knots, or feel the shoulders tightening up, or feel the kind of the place where the heart maybe is being to beat faster, or where you're starting to sweat, or wherever it might be that you have the symptoms of physically of fear, some people find that dropping into the body drops them out of the cycle of thinking, the fueling that thinking does. But more importantly, dropping into the body and feeling in the body sometimes is kind of like making space for the fear. It's kind of like if you're involved in your thoughts and your imagination and ideas, or you're reacting against the fear or contracting around it and all that, the fear has no space. In a way, that's kind of like a spring, which is kind of pushed down, the jack-in-the-box spring, pushed down the box. It has no room and take the lid off. If you take the lid off, the spring comes out, and then it expends all its energy, right? And then just they are kind of, you know, floppy. So if you make space for your fear, not that it becomes floppy, but it begins to kind of open up and become easier because it's more spacious. And sometimes the fear has a chance to unwind or dewind or fade away or something, if there's space just to feel it. And the body is one of the places to make space for it. Just hold it in the body, feel it. See what happens when you with your fear. The part of the investigation of fear is to become aware of what you think the danger is. What's the threat? What's being threatened? What's being threatened in you? Are you really clear about specifically what the threat is? If it's anxiety about social anxiety, what is it about you that you're afraid is going to happen to you? Are you afraid of being rejected? Are you afraid of being embarrassed? Are you afraid of, you know, what is it in particular? And then put a question mark behind that idea of what's threatened. Is it really something that's worthwhile being concerned about? Is it really the primary thing that, you know, does it have the importance that somehow your emotional life is giving it? And sometimes by doing some careful reflection about the particular thing that feels threatened, you can kind of begin to see that maybe your thinking isn't quite as wise as you are, if you're given a little bit of time to think about it. Because fear is very closely connected to kind of the irrational sides or the emotional centers in our system that is sometimes not necessarily the wisest parts of us. So if we can let the fear be and step back and understand it and then reflect and contemplate, sometimes we have a chance to be wiser and then to begin to maybe have a different relationship to it. And this is what happened to me in this, you know, these days after I was thinking about this meeting, afraid of this meeting. It was only after the meeting was canceled that I got to be wise. because then I had the space to kind of then reflect and think. And that reflection then opened the door for further understanding of this whole complex I had of anticipating the future and being afraid of it. So to actually be able to contemplate and think about these things is very important. And I think as many of you know that fear, sometimes is kind of biological instinct, you know, kind of. But sometimes the fears we have come from our conditioning, meaning that they come from our life experiences. And some, if we have particularly powerful experiences that, you know, that are filled with loss or filled with suffering or pain, accidents, acts of violence, tremendous loss. Sometimes the earlier in life they happen, the more they become, they deeply condition us. It's kind of like they get locked in, or the miglia somehow begins operating a certain way, and it's almost like we can't help it because it's so almost, you know, almost wired into our system, these kinds of traumas. And so to you know, simply say be mindful of it might not be helpful, might not actually work so well. Sometimes mindfulness is not enough, in spite of what sometimes the mindfulness tradition wants to say. Just be mindful of things and thinks that everything will be better. And sometimes when there's deep, deep conditioning around trauma, you need to sometimes decondition, recondition, meet that conditioning with something that helps it to relax and unwind in a deep way. And there's a few things that can help with the conditioning of fear. One is to have a lot, have strong feeling of safety. Without some strong kind of container of feeling really safe and really know that you're safe, sometimes it's hard for certain parts of our psyche or mind to relax. And some people have a tremendous need for safety. They have need for safety more, you know, maybe more than they need food sometimes, because of you grew up in war zones. And so to go someplace where they really feel safe is really important. For some people, that's been a function of some of the retreat centers, like Spirit Rock and maybe our retreat center down in Santa Cruz. That I've known people at Spirit Rock who said there was the first time in their life where they felt safe around a group of people in some place. You know, they dawned on them after some days of being at Spirit Rock that they had been sleeping in rooms and buildings that were not locked. You know, they never had the experience in their life of feeling safe enough to be in a situation where the doors were not unlocked, their bedroom doors unlocked, their building doors unlocked, and all that. For those of you now who don't want to go to Spirit Rock, I'll tell you that Spirit Rock now has locks on the bedroom doors, not because people are afraid, but because a few years ago there were some thefts, and so now they give people the option if they want to lock their rooms so that protect their things. Very unfortunate. And I think one of the reasons it's very unfortunate because as soon as you have locks, I think there's kind of a, this kind of feeling of safety changes. And so, you know, I think when there was no locks, there's a different kind of letting go. I felt, oh, this is a safe place. The other thing that kind of that helps recondition the psychological conditioning around fear is cultivating a lot of well-being. And one of the very important functions of meditation practice is to create joy, is to create a sense of well-being, a sense of warmth, subtleness, safety. And the joy or the happiness that can come from meditation is a very powerful reconditioning force on the mind. To be able to feel a kind of happiness or well-being that is not caused by things in the world. It's not caused by, you know, getting nice things in the world or nice experiences or being with nice people or, you know, having success at work or none of the worldly things that can cause us to be happy. But to have a happiness that wells up from the inside and kind of suffuses us from the inside. And we kind of feel and kind of trust and relax and soften around this happiness is very healing. And one of the ways that some people will find this well-being that kind of combines the benefits of two things is a loving-kindness practice. Some people who have a lot of fear find tremendous benefit from doing metta practice, this loving-kindness practice, meditation on love, and feeling this divine love that, you know, kind of wells up from the inside, that kind of is generated from our heart, in a sense, and flows out. This can be so powerful that it's as powerful as the effect of trauma on our mind. And so something begins to be countered, something softens, something changes, something gets relearned about the mind, relearns how to be. And it learns that it can relax and let go, and it learns it can have an open heart, it learns it can have an open mind and not be afraid in that kind of situation. So sometimes mindfulness is not enough. Sometimes we want to look and see, what can we do that can counter the deep conditioning that we have of it. The last thing I want to say about fear is repeating a little bit what I said, back to mindfulness, and that is that we want to learn to see the fear without being identified with it. To see the fear as just the fear, as opposed to it's my fear, and to be present for the fear, not react with it, not be for or against it, not be afraid of fear, not be angry with it, not be ashamed of it, not believe it, but just to see it clearly for what it is. And one of the things that really helps is to cultivate a capacity to be uncomfortable. And I think this is one of the great gifts of meditation practice and mindfulness practice, is it's one of the places where if you practice it in a in the way that's often taught, the gift of meditation practice is you can learn to be comfortable with discomfort. Isn't that great? So what that means is that if you're feeling uncomfortable for any reason at all, say when you're meditating, then don't do anything about it. Don't give in to it and move and adjust your posture or run away or say, well, enough for today. And don't give in to the impatience. Don't give in to the strong desires for comfort. Don't give in to the strong aversion. Don't give in to the self-pity that might arise. Don't give in to discouragement. There's all kinds of reactions we can have when we're uncomfortable. But the idea in meditation is literally and psychologically, don't move. Stay with it. I've learned so much. I felt very lucky that in some ways that my first training was in Zen meditation, where the rule was no moving in meditation. I mean, you weren't supposed to move. Once you sat in your posture, you didn't move until the end. And here, in our tradition now, here, Vipassana, you're welcome to move. And sometimes people move too much. Sometimes in Zen, they don't move enough. Hopefully there's a middle ground, which is just a sweet spot for everyone. If you don't move too easily when you sit and meditate. And learning how not to move, not to give in to the strong impulses to itch, to scratch an itch, to not give in to strong impulses to change when there's, a minor unproblematic pain, or don't kind of give up just because you're feeling uncomfortable. Don't move physically, but also then slowly learn not to move psychologically, meaning don't kind of get carried away with all the reactions that come up around being uncomfortable. Don't get carried away with all the beliefs of what it means. I'm the only one today who's uncomfortable in my meditation. Everyone else is sitting on a cloud, they're in the seventh samadhi, and I'm a failure as a meditator, and this is the proof of it. Poor me. But you don't give in, just don't go there. Don't let your mind keep to having those thoughts. Don't support those thoughts. Stop them. I had a very powerful experience of this when I was a Zen student, where we had, there was a particular retreat that I had to do called Tongariro, where it wasn't just not moving for 40 minutes, the usual length of meditation sessions. It was sitting in meditation and not moving for 3 to 4 hours. And it was kind of a little bit grueling. But one of the things I learned from that was I would have pain. My knees hurt. They were on fire. But I couldn't move. Was that if I had self-pity, the knees hurt more. And if I didn't have self-pity, they hurt less. And because it hurt so much, I had to be very, very attentive to my self-pity. And as soon as I kind of gave into it, oh. But if I didn't give into the self-pity and let go of that, then it wasn't, you know, then I could, you know, I don't know what to say. It was tolerable, or it just wasn't so bad. You know, and anyway, so I did make it through that retreat. And I was very happy for it. When the retreat finished, I teared up because I didn't know when it was going to end. Someone came in, so I was a part of the challenge of it. You know, it was just, you know, it was going to go on and on until I was just sitting there in the meditation hall, not knowing when it was going to end. And then I got this tap on my shoulder, and I knew it was over. And I think it was 5 days, something like five days or something like 7 days, 5 days. And I got this tap on the shoulder. And the reason I kind of teared up was that because of the intensity of all that, I really knew myself well. I'd never known myself so well inside. I never had such intimacy. I had to kind of be right there, every thought, every emotion, in order to, you know, just manage with that intensity, because of the self-pity and all these things kind of made it worse. And I felt so intimate with myself. And I thought, oh, I'll never be this intimate again, because it was so good to know myself so well. And eventually I learned you could be that intimate without the pain. So don't go rush off now and sit in pain. But the idea is that learning to be comfortable with discomfort is a very powerful lesson that can help you when time comes to be present for fear, because fear tends to be uncomfortable. And if you've learned how to stay present for fear and learned how you react and how you respond and learn not to give in and learn to kind of separate yourself a little bit from it, then when it's time for you to sit with anxiety, you have that experience of discomfort and you know some of the territory and you maybe have some confidence that you can sit there and be with it and see it for what it is and learn how to be free from it, even if you can't be free of it. It's a great thing to do. And it's a very much worthwhile thing to do. And we do it not just for ourselves, but for society as a whole. To free ourselves from our fear, free ourselves from being caught in the grip of fear, is contagious. When we live with fear, that's contagious. And we support the other people who are afraid if we share our fear. And as we get into the next presidential election season, we could use a lot of people who know how not to succumb to fear and reinforce it, because there's a lot of people spending millions and millions of dollars to try to frighten you. That's usually what happens in presidential elections. So it's one example of how it's good not to learn how to be wise about fear and anxiety and imagination. So those are my thoughts this morning. And if a few of you ever get afraid, maybe they're relevant. Any thoughts that you'd like, any questions you'd like to ask? Or
in my life, the most piercing, gripping, horrible anxiety and fear is when a child is in pain or threatened with pain.
Yeah.
Very, I mean, I can be more, I can't say it, I can be more even about facing or experiencing pain to myself, but with a child, I just, it's really gripping. It's like, it's hard to be observant of it, because it's just, you feel like you're not engaged somehow.
Yeah.
More observant of my own pain, but my child just draws me right in.
Yeah, so a child's pain draws you right in. You can observe your own. And so that's particularly for your children, or for, because you have young children, or?
No, they're between 20 and 30. Huh? But because of the way my life has gone, I was in a cult between the ages of 20 and 35, huh, and been recovering from that ever since. So they have a lot of psychological issues. So mostly for them, it's psychological pain that they've had.
As a legacy of that time when you were in a cult?
Yeah, they weren't born until after I was out, but it was a cult that taught an anti-mindfulness technique.
Mm-hmm.
And after 15 years, I got out with a full-blown dissociative disorder.
Mm.
I mean, high-spectrum depersonalization, derealization.
Mm.
And so I was struggling, been struggling ever since. So it's been really dysfunctional for them. And they're doing okay. I mean, but as I struggled to, actually, a friend introduced me to Anapanasati about 20 years ago, and I started chipping away at the dissociative disorder.
Nice.
And so I've been able to pull them along with me. So they're okay.
Uh-huh.
But many times I was just extremely afraid for them in their psychological well-being as to whether they'd recover from some certain psychological pit. So it was actually really terrifying.
Yeah, I can imagine. My first kind of response to you telling me this is that you're concerned for your kids and their welfare and, you know, and how strong it is speaks really well for the parent-child bond that you have with them.
We're actually really close.
Yeah.
I feel really fortunate for that. We emerged from all this really.
Yeah, so I'm touched by that and can feel that. So I want to just say this is important that you have that. You're lucky that you have that's a strong connection. And of course you would feel concerned with your children this way, and especially if there's a legacy in the past that you're responsible for some, then there's some sense of responsibility, and there could be some complicated emotions of guilt and shame that's connected to it perhaps, that or needing to make amends for what you did that are all making it more intense for you. All things which can be appropriate and can be done in a healthy way if you find, you know, there's a healthy route to take with this kind of stuff.
So I've been chipping away at the dissociation, which is, I mean, really chipping away like a Shawshank rock hammer. Chip, chip. And lately, in the last couple of months, things have, I feel like they hit a tipping point. And so I kind of wanted to talk about that with somebody.
Sure. Maybe afterwards we can talk a little bit then. And and then in terms of the strength in which you feel your fear for children more than for yourself, for kids more than yourself, I don't know you well enough, but it's fairly common when for parents, and I had this as well with my kids, that the unresolved kind of, you know, suffering we have as children, we kind of project it on our kids.
Yeah, I don't want them to go through it.
And so we don't go through them. We're afraid they're going to go through it, and we look for them. So sometimes the parents need to kind of go back and revisit some of their own difficulties as children and kind of settle something, resolve something. Because I've seen that I had my own kind of unresolved things with being, you know, growing up. And then I kind of assumed my kids were going to go through the same things in school when they went. And they wasn't there at all, right? all concerned. So I had to kind of look at that earlier one. And sometimes people will have very deep unresolved issues, emotional issues, that get kind of rather than dealing with it inside personally, when there's very strong distress about things in the world outside or others or children or something, it's kind of like redirected. And the sense of horror or distress about something out in the world is a redirected or substituted way of some deep issue in oneself. And so the more strongly distressed people have about the world, I've seen, the more likely it is that it's a personal distress that really needs the attention.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, because I've been working my way out of a nightmare since I got out of the cult.
Uh-huh.
So I do kind of project that possibility onto them.
It seems like you're doing wonderful, like great. Given where you came from, you seem like you're doing great.
Yeah, I am actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, and especially just recently. It's only recently I've been able to sit for any length of time.
Hmm.
And like I said, when a dissociative disorder is like, you know, your analogy of the house and the easy chair. A dissociative disorder is like you can't sit in the easy chair. There is no easy chair. There is no house. You're just in a world. Your universe is thought and constructions of thought. And so it's really hard for people to get out of those things. And so just recently, so finally things shifted to where the dissociative reality, always up till recently, the mindfulness reality seemed a bit abnormal and actually scary.
Yeah.
And it was attractive, obviously, somehow, but it was also really scary. And it didn't seem really abnormal. The dissociative state seemed normal. And just in the past couple of months, it switched, it tipped, like all of a sudden to where the mindfulness seems, the state of mind awareness seems normal, and the dissociative reality seems not attractive anymore. Mm. So it's a big deal.
Yeah, congratulations, big deal, wonderful. I know a teeny bit about dissociated because of, I mean, I was young, my fear was pretty strong when I was young, and I attribute to the practice that it's so much of it's gone. I remember the first time I had a one-on-one private meeting with a Buddhist teacher, I was so nervous I couldn't speak. And the teacher said, "Gil, just breathe deeply." So that's where I came from, right? That's, you know, now people are afraid to see me. I won't roar too loud. And then I remember in college once, first time I had to go see a professor in freshman year in college, I had to go see the professor in his office. And so I sat down in a chair and across from him, and I kind of like, after a while, I kind of disappeared, and I thought it was really strange that he was kept looking at the wall because I wasn't there. And I thought it was really odd. And the next thing I knew, I was walking down the hall leaving. I have no idea what happened in the office. But I wasn't there. So it's good work. It's really good work to work with fear. And it's not nothing to be ashamed of, nothing to be, you know, you don't have to see it as like you're wrong in any kind of way. It's basic human thing to deal with fear. It's really good work. And we don't just do it for ourselves. We do it for others as well. So I encourage you to become curious and interested in fear, from the teeniest little fretting to the full-blown terror that you might have. It's all good work. And I hope that all of you can have the taste of being, that the life of being fearless becomes the normal. Thank you.